We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your hosts, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 329. It has been three games against the Mariners, three very different games. Three games. There's a lot to talk about, Scott. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, we've gotten some mixed results with the Mariners, I'd say. I mean, this series could be very different right now if we didn't have some Gio Urshela heroics in the ninth inning of a rained, you know, lengthened game. But here we are looking for a series win tonight.
Yeah, it was. We're recording, just so everyone knows, Thursday morning, and like you said, we've gotten a couple. We got the rain to deal with. We've had the pine tar to deal with, a walk off to deal with. So it has been a wild series, and this thing isn't even over.
No, it's not. And you know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know my thoughts about Seattle. I can't stand the team. I'm still scarred for life from 1995. Them sending off Don Mattingly. It's way too early, and then him being never seen again on the field with the Yankees. So it was a weird year when Tino came over and took our captain's spot, the guy who knocked us out. And I've ever since I've always hated the Seattle Mariners.
Isn't it a little like just funny how baseball works, where the Yankees get Michael Pineda from the Mariners, mm-hmm. who has the pine tar incident.
Right.
And then the Mariners have Kikuchi on the mound, who has pine tar or some sort of substance under his hat against the Yankees. They're not saying anything about it. And I saw you tweet this, and I thought this is just another great connection, that Aaron Boone was in the ESPN booth on the night of that Yankee-Red Sox game when Pineda had the pine tar.
Yeah, so after I saw it, I was looking back and just I was rewatching what happened with Pineda, like how it went down with the with Farrell and the whole thing. I was just trying to refresh my memory, and I was like, "Holy shit! Aaron Boone is on the damn broadcast. This was an ESPN game. I had forgotten that." And talking about how, you know, Pineda's essentially forcing their hand to mm-hmm. look at things and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, well,
this is I find this fascinating. I believe we have talked about this a while ago. With pine tar, what year was that, by the way, for Pineda and the pine tar? Were we doing a podcast at that point?
Yeah. I don't remember the year.
Okay, so that was 2015 or 2016, sometime in there.
Yeah.
Trust, when you're doing a podcast twice a week for the entire season, time does not exist. Seasons do not exist. It just goes on and on and on. But it was the whole discussion. It's a cat and mouse game, right? If you are so obvious about it and you're rubbing it in the other team's face, you're going to force them to say something. But teams don't want to really say anything because their pitchers are doing it too. Whether it's pine tar or the bullfrog, right? Isn't like bullfrog
the sticky
like
stuff
lotion or something? Yeah. Sunscreen. Bullfrog lotion, like there's always something going on. Like you remember,
what's his face was drenched.
Clay Buchholz,
like, yeah, Clay Buchholz. Clay Buchholz.
It would be 40 degrees outside, and it looked like he's in a sauna. His hair was.
He
so
looked
wet.
Like CeCe on a 95 degree day. Yeah,
and it's for a better grip, and that's obviously what Kikuchi was doing last night. I mean, you could see him.
Well, the lotion is the opposite. The lotion is for something so you can get some movement, some slickness on it as well, so you can get a little bit of a.
Whatever it is, whether it's to get a better grip on the ball or to get more movement on the ball, there's a substance used to doctor the baseball in some way.
Yes.
Kikuchi clearly had like a slathering of it on the underside of his cap, and in between every pitch, he was adjusting his hat multiple times. And that is how the whole thing sort of came about. I'm going to give a shout out to Pete Wise. He tweeted me. At some point in the game, I want to say in the sixth inning or maybe early seventh inning, he tweeted, "Hey, is anyone going to say anything about the fact that Kikuchi has pine tar under his hat?" And I had not noticed the pine tar under his hat to that point. I had noticed that he was adjusting his hat a lot because as soon as I saw that tweet, I was like, yeah, he is adjusting his hat a lot. Like, what's that about? And then Pete.
It's a cultural thing. It's you know.
Yeah.
Don't say anything. You might get labeled as a bigot. You watch out.
That's just what Japanese pitchers do. They pitch once a week and they like to
and they adjust their hats.
But see, like
how dare you?
as we're saying that, you and I are recording video, and we're both wearing hats, and I just adjusted my hat as we were saying that. So it's kind of a normal thing. But I went back, and right before the Talkman bloop hit, there was the Yes just had a camera angle where you could see the underside of his hat, and it was clearly visible, the substance. So I tweeted out that video.
It's pine tar. Let's not even just, that was a gob of pine tar.
It was pine tar. Yeah, whatever it was. And so that was like the first instance of when you could see it. That video kind of went around social media. Everyone was tagging the Yes Network, tagging Michael Kay. They finally brought it up like an inning later, and apparently that's when Boone knew about it too, because in his post-game press conference he said, "I didn't find out about it until about the eighth inning."
Yeah, I mean, so it's now you're looking at it and you're wondering, well, if he knew about it in the fourth inning, the third inning, would they have said something at that point if it was in the back of their mind, and then they just keep seeing him going to the hat? Because they probably wouldn't in the beginning. But then if you knew about that in the third or fourth inning and you saw him going to his cap, the amount of times that he did, it would have driven them insane not to say something. I mean,
Especially as you're getting no hit. If it's a close game and you're getting base runners against him and you're just close to scoring, then maybe you just let it go. But when you're getting blown out and it's a no hitter, maybe you just say, screw this. We're going to say something.
Well, or it could have been in a different context, in the sense that, in between innings, you say something to the umpire. Hey, just so you know, we know, like, just change the hat, something like along those lines.
And that might get in Kikuchi's head, and that might change the whole tone of the game.
It very well could. And like something like that would be more along the rules of, you know, the unsaid rules in baseball, where you don't bring it up, not what Farrell did, and just make a whole big thing about it in front of their home.
Well, of course. Red Sox are going to do that.
Yeah. But in between innings and doing something like that, I could have seen Boone doing that, but I bet they would have said something if they knew about it earlier. I'm surprised they didn't know about it.
This can't be the first time Kikuchi's done this. So other teams must have experienced this at some point in the season, and they haven't said anything.
Yeah.
I have a hard time believing this was the first game Kikuchi has pitched this season.
No, there's no way.
Right.
You don't just walk into a new game with pine tar and experiment, and you have experience with it.
Right.
But again, this is something
that's a little chilly last night, but it wasn't bad weather by any means.
Full scope of this entire thing. Many players talk about this in a sense that they really could care less, especially the offensive players, the guys who are in the box. They don't care if the pitcher has pine tar, the ones that I've heard from and over the years, because they can grip it better and because they can control it better. They don't want a guy going out there with the lack of control, and if they can help it with control. But last night being different, it was not a cold night. You're saying it was cool, but when you're playing, like, you could still get some moisture on your hands last night. It's not like it was a frigid night. Well, so there really was no reason for it.
Opinions differ, because don't you remember Trevor Bauer tweeting about the spin rate with the Astros, saying, oh, I know how to increase spin rate too. Pine tar.
Yeah.
So pine tar can give you a competitive advantage on the mound, other than just gripping the ball better. Oh. If it's increasing your spin rate,
but
that
makes
your fastball better.
That's why it does, because you can grip it better, so you can get a tighter spin on it. I totally agree. I'm not saying that it doesn't enhance it. It does. What I'm saying is that I think a lot of players don't care, because either their guys are doing it as well, or if it is a really cold night, it does help with the control, and that's, you know, they're just trying to stay on the field as long as they possibly can as a Major League Baseball player.
It goes back to the whole don't rub it in our faces thing. I remember that playoff game against the Tigers. I remember when Kenny Rogers had his entire left thigh was covered in a brown substance.
Yeah.
And he kept rubbing his thigh. It was pine tar, or it was something. And he was dominating the Yankees in a playoff game, which was extremely frustrating, because this was like 2006. And 10 years earlier in 1996, that jackass couldn't get out of the third inning of a World Series game against the Braves because he sucks. And here he is a decade later shoving the bats up the Yankees' ass in the playoffs. And you're like, Torrey, go out and say something. And he didn't. And the Yankees lost the game. The Yankees lost the series. I'm getting heated over here.
And that's from the old school. That's exactly what they would not do. They wouldn't go out there and they wouldn't show up the opponent. They knew that pine tar was in the game all over the place. And it just was one of those things that, you know, unless you're completely throwing it in our face. And in the Kenny Rogers instance, he kind of was. Pineda was. I mean, it was right there. And So I don't know. I think still, when you look back at it, though, a lot of people don't agree with what Farrell did either. Like, let it go. Just don't say anything. You could even
see, that was the same thing where Pineda was dominating the Red Sox.
Yeah, you could even see in that video when I was looking back at it, and they pulled him. I mean, just like so many of the guys, like Brian Roberts was the first person I noticed who was playing second base, by the way, another one of those obscure Yankees. But he was shaking his head like in disgust, like he can't believe the Red Sox called him out. You're challenging my Brian Roberts.
I'm just looking up. No, I'm just looking up when he was with the Yankees.
Yeah, it was
because I don't remember. God,
but the yeah, he was
in 2014. So that was 2014.
Yeah, I guess
we did not have a podcast then.
No, we didn't. See, it all blends together. Feels like we've been doing this for 20 years.
You were saying?
I don't even remember.
That Brian Roberts was pissed off.
You can just tell that the guys were in disgust.
Oh, that's an yeah.
You can just tell that these guys were in disgust. You know, it's like one of those unsaid rules. Like, you don't do that. Now we're going to hit you.
You know what? So Kenny Rogers had it on his thigh. Michael Pineda had it on his neck. Kikuchi had it on the underside of his hat. Still obvious, but less obvious than a thigh or a neck.
Right.
Right?
Still concealed. A lot of guys generally concealed. Yeah.
A lot of guys put it in the palm of the glove, so it's even more concealed than the hat. I think the hat is still in the category of too obvious.
Especially when you're going to it that consistently. And it's another motion that you're doing. You're literally putting your thumb under there to grab some pine tar, adjust the hat, and put it on your hands.
The other argument is, well, if teams don't really care about it, then why don't they put it on the mound next to the rosin bag?
Well, that's the thing, because the rosin bag essentially is for the same purpose. It's for, you know, a similar purpose in the sense that it's going to dry your hand if you're sweating too much so that you can get a grip on the ball. So if you're using a rosin bag to dry your hand off and to get a better grip on the ball, then where's the line on pine tar or whatever else it is? So, yeah, the whole point of I think the rosin bag and why people have an issue sometimes, the people that do have an issue with the pine tar is like, hey, they're giving you something to help you out already that's legal. Mm. So now you're taking it another level and going for something that's sticky, that really gives you, you know, a significant grip on the ball. Whereas the rosin bag just kind of dries your hand off, gives you, you know, just the touch back, the feel back. It's not something that's going to, you know, make it stick.
And why are batters allowed to use pine tar and pitchers aren't?
You know, that's another one of those
but
things.
Batters are allowed to use pine tar up to a certain point on the bat. It's like
there's some dumb rules in baseball
gets so gimmick. It's just so weird with all these like rules, unwritten rules. Where's the line? Did you cross the line? What is the
because
point
you see batters
and not cheating.
You see batters, and Gary Sanchez had it the other day. Pine tar all over his helmet.
His helmet.
So they'll use it for for that case. They were talking about him using it for, you know, the beads of rain coming off to catch that, or
which then he wiped it off.
Just touching it. Yeah, I don't really think it was for that. I don't think he was like going it. That would be a little Bill Nye for me for Gary Sanchez, to tell you the truth.
I don't know. Nerds might have told him about that one.
I think it was more for just gripping gripping your bat, taking your helmet off in between and getting another grip.
Well, while we're talking about this Wednesday game, was this the reason the Yankees got blown out?
No. They couldn't hit him. That's for sure. I mean, so whether the pine tar had something to do with that or not, you know, I think that's up to everybody's view, whoever was watching this game.
Couldn't hit him, and they couldn't hit Marco Gonzalez, the guy who pitched against them the night before, and they're very similar pitchers.
That's
both left-handed, soft throwing, a lot of breaking stuff, always on the edges, trying to make you expand the strike zone. They struggle with Gonzalez. They struggle with Kikuchi.
This isn't the first time you see them struggle with a guy that you know, paints corners and can, you know, has some good off-speed stuff, we'll change it up a lot. Like, that's the prototypical guy that the Yankees struggle with. So that does not surprise me. I think it's more the style of the pitcher than the pine tar. But maybe the pine tar had something to do with it.
You know? And the pine tar...
It's more fun to say that the pine tar was the reason they got dominated. The pine tar was the only reason. He would have been knocked around the park if it wasn't for the damn pine tar.
Let's get mad online, Scott. That's our job as podcasters, as bloggers. Our job is to get angry online.
Goddamn Kikuchi, who does he think he is? Coming over with his pine tar, tipping his cap.
How dare Kikuchi put pine tar on the bill of his cap? And then Loaisiga, sitting in the Yankees dugout, seeing that, pissed off that he can't use pine tar, and that's why he went out there and sucked ass.
Yeah, or he's just, you know, he very well could have just put it on his brim too.
Well, Loaisiga, you could. I heard Boone talking about after the game how there's flashes with Loaisiga where he shows his 97 mile an hour fastball and he's getting a swing and miss on it, but he's also in a seven pitch at bat and he just can't put the hitter away. He is throwing a ton of pitches. I think he had something like 40 up in the 40s of pitches late into the second inning. It's completely unsustainable. He only goes through four innings, gives up four runs. Luis Sessa comes in. Looked pretty good. He gave up a home run to Edwin Encarnacion. We just saw Nelson Cruz with the Twins, who I feel like they're just the same player, right-handed home run hitter who kills the Yankees.
Yeah, and has been playing forever. I thought Sessa looked pretty good, actually. Even, you know, that first at bat, he's got some really good stuff. He really does. We've been talking about this for a long time, and it seems like he's starting to put it together and get a lot more confidence. We saw that after, spring training, and he had a good spring. So, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording, but it's possible after what we saw with Loaisiga that, you know, maybe that they start Sessa out as an opener, quote unquote, as a starter, because he's not fully stretched out, but he could certainly go 3-4 innings, I'd say, or, you know,
which is what Loaisiga gave you last night. So if next turn around the rotation, you go Sessa for 3 or 4 innings, then maybe the next time out, he's ready for a 5-inning start.
It's possible. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I think that right now they should try to capitalize on him as much as possible, because he does look good. He's probably the most confident we've seen him as a professional, and we need another starter. So, I think it's time to see what he's got in that spot, and then they can fill in, because they have bullpen arms. They have bullpen arms that can go in there and clean up games and do some mop up duty if they need to. That are relatively good options. I mean, on any other team would be, you know, a solid option. So I think that there is room for that. And, you know, right now starting pitching depth is the problem.
And they've right now used Sessa only in low leverage situations. Rohan wrote an awesome article about bullpen usage on the website a couple days ago. Definitely go check that out. But he breaks down how the Yankees are using each of their bullpen arms by what leverage they're using them in, and then win probability added. And what you find out through that article is that, one, Tommy Canley has been almost underused. He's been so good, and he has not been put in high leverage situations to this point. He's starting to get there, right? They're starting to use him deeper into the game. But a lot of that came early in the season when they still didn't trust Tommy Canley. So that's one takeaway from the article. The other is, maybe don't use Jonathan Holder in such key spots, because the dude is still struggling. And we saw it on Monday when CC hit a wall in the fifth inning, loaded the bases. They let him face Jay Bruce, which I was questioning that move, but they let him face Jay Bruce. He got a weak ground out from Jay Bruce. Then Holder comes in and immediately puts runners on base in the sixth inning. And it's like, here we are all over again. It's another heart attack.
I mean, that being said, Holder over his last, you know, 3-4 appearances has been a lot better and much more effective. So because of that, I think that Boone is trying to, you know, build on that as much as they can, because he's still a key piece of this bullpen. I mean, whether you think that he's not a guy that's going to be in these big high leverage situations, or he's going to be a guy that comes in as a bridge to some of these guys in a, you know, 2-3 run game in a, you know, that's a decently high leverage situation, but he's been good for his last. He struggled in the very beginning. Him and Chad Green both had bad starts. Chad Green couldn't fix it. Jonathan Holder seemed like he was fixing it and was getting back into a good groove. And I still think that he's been pitching much better. And yes, he did struggle on Monday night, but I'm not killing the Holder move as much anymore, just because he seemingly has turned his season around a little bit.
But the problem is that even just because it's the fifth or sixth inning doesn't make it a low leverage situation. It might be in the middle of the game, but sometimes that is when the game
sure
can turn.
Yeah, no, I get that. I get that. And you're saying you'd rather see in a game like that, Tommy Canley coming in and locking it down.
Because you don't know what's going to happen in the seventh inning. What if the Yankees score four runs in their half of the seventh inning? And then you don't need Tommy Canley. You don't need Adam Ottavino. Why not take care of the game when you need it to be taken care of?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other side of that is, if you're using Canley that early in a relatively close game, well, if it becomes closer later, then you don't have your best relievers on hand.
Yes,
ready to go.
I'm fully aware of that. So, it is not an easy decision. But if it is why Aaron Boone is being paid millions of dollars,
but, and that's
and the nerds are all there, and why you and I are here.
And that's why when you see Holder, who's pitching a lot better, I got no problem with him coming in at that point after what he's done over his last 3 to 4 appearances. So it's to me, it was much of a non-issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't work out for Holder. It worked out for the Yankees.
Right, Holder was they had to pull him.
Right,
and
Ottavino pitched his way out of a
luckily
huge jam.
Luckily the Yankees scored 7 runs early off of Felix Hernandez, who does not look like the same pitcher anymore. He hasn't looked like the same pitcher for a while, but they get a couple home runs off of him. Estrada hits his first career home run, and I think it's he was very fired up and he hit it because he's from Venezuela. Felix Hernandez is from Venezuela. Felix Hernandez is like a god in Venezuela. So that must have been like a unbelievable moment for Estrada. But then you saw Felix Hernandez kind of figure shit out middle of that game where him and Sabathia kind of flipped. CeCe was cruising in the first couple innings. Hernandez was getting knocked around. And then Sabathia kind of hit a wall, had to battle through 5 innings, and the bullpen did hold it down, but it got a little nerve-wracking.
I mean, it was when you're watching Felix Hernandez come out there and you just go shot, shot, shot. I mean, it was just, it seemed like the ball was flying out every other pitch.
Voight starting off that game.
Yeah. Voight starting off that game with a 2-run shot. And he's been really good in the first inning. He's a guy that puts the Yankees on top early and often. And, you know, it's crazy when you're looking at what the lineup is now and you see Voight on a lot of days in that 2 spot. It's just nuts. It's absolutely nuts seeing that guy in the 2 spot in this lineup. But Gardy doing it, and then Estrada, like you said, and Estrada made a great play too on in that 6th inning Holder was there, when Ottavino was there actually, and charged in and made a good play at short. So he's been really good, and you know, that's, we talked about that. That's one of the interesting things, right? Like Tyler Wade going down. I don't remember if we were talking about this on air or before, but
no, yeah. So for the Loaisiga call up, they sent down Tyler Wade instead of Estrada, and I think that's telling to where they project down the line. They want to give Estrada more looks, is what I'm thinking right now. They know they've seen Tyler Wade for a good chunk of the season in the role that he's never going to be more than the role than what we've seen. A bench player who comes in and plays defense and occasionally gets a start whenever they need to give guys days off. And he's hitting 200. Okay. Like, I don't know how many more chances Tyler Wade is going to get to hit. He's never going to get for the Yankees 500 at-bats in a season. It's never going to happen.
I gotta tell you, I really hope it never gets to that point, because I don't want to see 500 Tyler Wade at-bats.
But if the argument is, oh, Tyler Wade hits in the minors.
I don't think that's the argument anymore. I think the argument is that he can hit
the
minors.
It was for a little while, though. It was for a little while he needs every day at-bats to really show the type of player he can be.
I don't think it was an argument. I think it was an observation of, okay, this is what he's done in the minor leagues. Maybe that's what he needs in the major leagues. I don't know if anybody was saying, well, you know, Tyler Wade's going to hit 300 if he gets X amount of at bats.
Yeah,
we're just,
I don't
more
think
like, let's see what happens if he gets some more at bats. Like, at this point, I'm like, let's not give him any more at bats. Like, I like Tyler Wade as a situational player on this team, as a defensive replacement, as a guy who can run the bases, maybe lay down a bunt occasionally. That's how I like him.
But you don't need to see that anymore. You know he can do that. So let's see Estrada has.
Yeah. I'm fine with that.
Yeah. And it's going to be decisions when guys start coming back. Urshela has clearly played his way into a roster spot on this team. Now Estrada is going to try and play himself into a roster spot on this team. I think the outfield is going to get interesting, because once they get outfielders back, when and if they do, I mean, they're down 3 outfielders right now, but Stanton and Hicks should be back fairly soon. Judge later in the season.
Hicks is talking about this weekend. They're saying possibly him returning. So he's around the corner, much closer than Stanton at this point.
Maben or Talkman's going to have to go, and then the other one's going to have to go when the rest of the guys come back. So everyone's playing for a roster spot. They're giving Estrada a look, which I'm fine with. We buried the lead of this episode would have been the amazing comeback on Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Had it not been for Pintar. But the Tuesday game, it was not going the Yankees' way, and then you get a rain delay, and you're like, this is the last thing I want to do right now, sit through a 50-minute rain delay while the Yankees just are not doing anything, wasting opportunities. They're sloppy in the field. So you had the ball drop in between Frazier and Gardner in the outfield. Then you had Frazier just had one clank off of his glove. And I'm kind of thinking, the camera zooms in on Clint Frazier anytime he makes a mistake, and you can sort of just see him. yelling at himself internally, right? Like you can just see, I can just see the gears of his brain.
I don't even see, I see it a little differently. I don't see him yelling at himself. I see him like embarrassed. I feel like he, when he makes a bad play, he's like, he just gets, he gets very down on himself.
Yeah.
And like, I can't believe I just did that. I can't
right,
believe.
Right, but he, you could tell he's talking to himself. Whatever he's yeah. saying, he's saying something in there.
Well, because there was a time in the, I tweeted this out, but there was a time later in the game when he made a routine play in right field and the crowd started, yes. you know, giving him our sarcastic Bronx cheer.
Which is fine. I mean, what's the difference between that and a guy strikes out and the whole crowd boos him?
Yeah, well, it's a difference when you're striking out, you know, 5-6 times in a row. That's more, it's a oh my God, you did a something that everybody in the stands can also
so
most likely do.
So in the order of jeers, it goes cheers is like, that's good. Then boos is bad. And then sarcastic cheers is the worst.
Probably the worst because it's condescending. And okay. when you get a sarcastic cheer, you're the guy catching the ball wide open in the middle of the outfield. No one's around you catching the ball. And he looks up and gives death stares and just starts scanning the crowd. Like I could see him like scanning the crowd, like check, got you, got you, got you, got you, locked into his brain. Because you know he holds that in. And you know he holds
grudge. I know he does. But I don't care. I didn't mind the crowd doing it.
No, I don't care either. I think that it's just telling about how what he is as a player and as a guy. He definitely listens to that and he hears it and he uses it because
we've talked about how
he internalizes this stuff. But
lets
I think it's
external
for,
noise get into his
but I think that he channels it for good. I think that whatever it is, he uses it as that chip on his shoulder, whether you and I believe or anybody believes that it should be, because most of us probably wouldn't, but he does. He uses it as a personal slight to him, and he'll go out there and prove you wrong, and I kind of like that. I don't care how that chip gets there.
That is the best way to deal with that sort of thing. So if he's doing that, love it. But we saw it in Houston when he missed the diving catch the first time, and then he missed the diving catch the second time around. And then he starts getting in his own head and he's tentative on a ball.
Yeah, but he also went on a tear.
We don't want that.
Offensively.
No, let me, I know, let me finish. Then he went on a tear. But then on Tuesday, he has the ball drop. The ball drops in between him and Gardner. Whose fault is that?
I don't know. I mean, they got to talk. Gardner, if Gardner's not saying anything, like it seemingly, if you look at where the ball was, it was probably Clint's ball. And if Gardner's not saying anything, then he's just got to feel the ball unless Gardner says something. So I don't know what the communication was between them. If he heard something that he thought, you know, he thought he heard something, who knows? The blame could go both ways, but they got
to
communicate.
The blame could go both ways because on the flip side, center, it always default to the center fielder.
Unless he's not saying anything, then field the ball. You should always go after the ball unless you're called off. That's where people are arguing about this on social media. Like, oh, the center fielder's going to do it. The center fielder does take control if it's his ball. If he's not saying anything and you're camped under the ball and you're right there, catch the ball because nobody's talking to you. But I don't know what their communication was on the field.
Right. So maybe let's just, for the sake of this argument, say it's 50-50 down the middle fault on that play. But Frazier gets in his own head about that, saying, shit, like I made a bad play there. And Tanaka was even kind of animated on the mound.
Kind of. He was animated.
You rarely see Tanaka get pissed off at other people.
Yeah, you don't.
He never shows up as teammates. He gets mad at himself. He gets excited about a big strikeout. But he is very, and this is, I think, part of Japanese culture. You don't show up your teammates. That is a big no-no.
Yeah, yeah. I think he yelled something in Japanese like, you're so worried about your shoes, catch the goddamn ball.
Yo, why?
Yeah, yo, why? So there's, he definitely was visibly upset.
And it was immediate.
It was like a very genuine initial reaction, pissed off Tanaka.
And I kind of liked it.
I
think it's because Tanaka knew I'm out here battling with like 20% of my stuff right now. I can't be giving away outs.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's frustrating when you see a major leaguer drop a ball.
And then, then he dropped it. So the ball dropped in between him. And then in a few innings later, the Frazier just flat out dropped a ball.
Just dropped
it.
Clanked
off of his glove. Did the rain affect him? Was it in his head from the last time? Did he expect Gardner to be running over? Who the hell knows? All I know is that ball needs to be caught. And that was the seventh inning. Then the rain started up. They had to pull Tanaka. Yankees get out of that inning. And then Canley comes in the next inning. And very uncharacteristic, Gio Urshela makes an error. He's now made two errors in this series. Dude gets all high and mighty on himself. He's tying ball games, going deep to Monument Park. He's like, I don't need to field anymore. That's the whole reason he's here. Makes an error, and it looks like the game is on ice with a couple of insurance runs from Seattle. And the Yankees missed an opportunity in the seventh inning to score. They missed an opportunity in the eighth inning to really tack on more runs, but it was Anthony Swarzak, that dude. Good friend Anthony Swarzak.
I was so happy to see him. I was so happy. Thank you, Mets, for dealing him to the Seattle Mariners.
That guy tortured us so much in 2016. Thank God it came back around, and we got a little redemption for it. Home run, Gio Urshela to center field. I sarcastically tweeted signature Yankee moment for him. And then Mr. Clutch himself, DJ LeMahieu, wins it. I want to run through a couple of DJ LeMahieu stats.
Before you do, was there any doubt in your mind that he was going to get a base hit?
No. And I said that immediately on the post-game recap. I was like, I knew he was going to at least put bat on ball and hit the ball hard somewhere.
I was writing the tweet like, I have zero doubt in my mind that this is going to be a base hit and we're going to win the game. And before I could even finish the tweet, he hits a base hit to the other way. And, you know, very, very close to that, to Jeter's last at bat. It really was, if you see them side by side.
Current runners in scoring position, 15 for 29. That is a 517 batting average.
That's crazy.
Batting average doesn't matter unless you're hitting fucking 500.
Or under 200. The approach that the guy takes at every single at bat doesn't change. It doesn't change. He puts bat on ball. He has a good approach. He has a he works the zone. He looks for things, you know, in his wheelhouse. He goes with the pitch. Doesn't try to do too much with something. That's why you see him going to right field all the time. That's why all the Yankee nerds said LeMahieu was going to be perfect for this this stadium. He's got the ability to go to the right side. Saw a little bit of launch angle change in him. But yeah, perfect at bat. Perfect base hit to the right side. Cameron Maben coming in with his little jump slide at the end. It was beautiful.
And I feel like it was a little NFL moment where anytime there's a touchdown, you can't celebrate immediately. You have to wait for the replay. And then, of course, we get a replay at home. And luckily, it was obviously safe. So DJ LeMahieu has played 32 games, and he has at least two hits in 13 of them. So more than a third of his games, he's getting two hits. And he's only not gotten a hit in 8 games. So he's more times he's getting two hits or one hit than no hits at all. It's just unbelievable the consistency. And we talked about this, I think, last episode or two episodes ago. He takes a week off, comes back, and immediately starts hitting again.
Yeah, because there's, you know, his mechanics are so clean that this guy just goes in there and does his job, man. He does not talk. He just goes out there and does his job. I mean, he barely celebrates.
Another play, and this goes under the radar for 95% of the people watching. But in Wednesday's game, when Romine threw that guy out at second base, you remember this play?
Yes.
It was a perfect throw, right? Like if there was nobody there and it was just the throw, it would have hit second base on the fly. So it's the perfect throw. But a lot of times what you see is the second baseman or the shortstop catch the ball in front and then have to reach back to tag. And by the time he does that, the guy slides in safe. LeMahieu just had his glove exactly where the runner was going to be sliding into it and just let the ball come to him and caught it and just dropped the glove right on the guy's arm. It was, yes, a perfect throw, but it was also a perfect tag. And that play goes under the radar, but it just shows how, like you said, fundamentally sound, how just consistent, nothing flashy about LeMahieu, just really good at a lot of things.
He's really good at a lot of things. And yeah, the ball will get to your glove faster than you can go get the ball and bring it back to the bag. So that's just one of those things that you see all the time. But it's got to be a perfect throw for that to happen, because a lot of time there's an adjustment with the tag, and there just was no adjustment. It was a perfect throw. So at that case, you have to, you know, have the patience and have the restraint and the muscle memory to just let the ball come to you. So
a lot of guys also don't want their glove there because they don't want to get slid into. So they'll bring the glove out. It's also a safety measure.
Sure.
So I get it, and it's a hard play all around, and it was a great play.
Or it's an easy play because you just put your glove there.
It's a hard play from a mental standpoint,
though. I don't think you're thinking about it at that point. You're just catching the ball and doing what you need. And literally, Austin Romine took every single thing out of the equation. Catch the ball. You don't even need to make a tag. Just
but
catch
a lot
the ball.
Of times, and Gleyber Torres is bad for this, where he catches the ball in front of the bag and has to reach back. It's a perfect throw,
there's a
it
discipline.
Doesn't matter because you're adding a half a second to catch the ball and reach back, and then that is the difference between safe or out.
There's no doubt there's a discipline being around second base and having the ability to make the tag based on what the throw is and adjusting the way that you do that.
Yeah. Frazier, since his return, so he was crushing the ball before he went on the injured list. He was leading the team in home runs and RBIs when he got hurt. He's 2-for-13 since his return. We got a little bit more information. So he said before he was activated, I had a grade 2 strain and 2 partially torn ligaments in my left ankle.
Yeah. So again, I mean, we've talked about this and I'm no doctor, but all you have to, it's a quick Google search to figure this out. A sprain is actually a tear. It's technically a tear. So when you're seeing torn ligaments and then a grade 2 sprain attached to it, you know, it just sounds worse than it really is.
Sounds a lot worse than
it's a twisted ankle. It's a sprained ankle is what it is. It's a sprained ankle. And then the degree of the sprain or the tears is what you're looking at. And because it was relatively minor, it only took him a little bit to come back. So I think like he's a very, very big timing guy, right? We needed his time to get back offensively. And I think he'll be fine. I'm not worried about that. But you see when he gets into a groove and he's feeling it, how he is. So you just need some more time, but they need him to be clicking offensively. Cause I think when he's going offensively, we'll see better defense too. Cause that's how he is.
I have a question for you. If you hurt your ankle, don't you think you want to wear the same shoe with the same support over and over again?
I mean, I don't think it matters as much in baseball. I think sometimes the
he's
movement.
Changing his cleats and his style of his cleats every night. There's a new cleat with a new new degree of like how high up the ankle goes every single night.
No, it's
I love the whole cleat thing. He's putting it on social media. People are loving it. I'm not a huge sneaker guy, so I don't really know the difference. But it's fun. I'm glad that people are enjoying it. But all I know is I want there to be support in that ankle, and some of these cleats don't look like they have a lot of support in that ankle.
No, it's true. Some of them are definitely mid-level to low cleats. I could never play in a high cleat ever. It used to bother me because it would restrict the movement too much.
Jeter used to play in some of those high tops. If you look back at some of like the 90s tapes, he has high top cleats.
Yep. I think it's just a personal preference, or some guys just don't care. But the cleat thing that he's doing, I mean, it's cool. Some people probably don't like it in New York. I could definitely see that happening. A lot of curmudgeon Yankee fans are probably looking at it and be like, this is distracting. Why is he thinking about the cleats?
Well,
who cares? All this
if
stuff.
If he's dropping balls,
it's going to be escalating.
Tweeting about his cleats, it's annoying. But if he's hitting home runs and tweeting about his cleats, then everyone loves it.
But what he's doing with the cleats, I think is kind of cool. And I'm not a big sneakerhead in the sense that like I know what every one of them are, but I can appreciate what looks good and what doesn't look good. And the fact that he's doing something different where he's putting cleats on shoes that are not supposed to be cleats. Like when I first heard that, I was like, is that a good idea? I mean, what are we doing here? Like that doesn't sound like a good idea, but you know, it's apparently fine the way that they're doing it. It's all good. But you know, he's wearing suede cleats last night. Like it's just kind of crazy how he's doing it. And changing some of these shoes to put on the cleats. I think it's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Tanaka, it's kind of funny. I think it was like 3 weeks ago that I had Conrad on to talk about how good Tanaka has been. And then since then, his season has kind of fallen apart. And he wasn't bad by any means on Tuesday. 6 1/3 innings pitched, 2 runs allowed. He allowed 1 home run and he was pulled in the rain delay. But like I said earlier, he was not pitching with his best stuff, and you could tell. He was figuring it out with basically just fastball slider. And the reason is because his splitter is getting absolutely bombarded. Here are some numbers. This year on his splitter, .417 batting average allowed, .792 slugging allowed, only a 15.9% whiff rate. Last year, 36% whiff rate on his splitter. Big, big difference on there.
That's a big difference. And they were even they were talking to Aaron Boone in one of the half innings or whatnot during the broadcast this series, and he acknowledged it. It's not like they don't know that this is an issue, that he's not working off of his splitter as much as he has in the past. I think when you're looking at what Tanaka is doing without his best pitch, it's also there's a level of being impressed too, because he's going out there with by far less than his best stuff and still being relatively effective and you know, controlling the games as much as he has. Yes, no, he has not been the same guy he was early on, but he's been good enough when you're looking at the fact that he doesn't have his best pitch.
On Tuesday, absolutely. But if you look at his season overall, he has four starts before Tuesday, four starts where he gave up just one earned run.
Yep.
And then three starts where he gave up three or more earned runs. And in two of them, it was five runs. It was the Grand Slam game, and then it was the game in Anaheim where all of a sudden Tanaka just lost it and you were kind of confused what happened. And then there was the game in Arizona where he was pulled after four innings because they pinch hit for him. Maybe he would have gone back out there, but he did give up three runs in four innings, which is not a good start.
The thing with him though, is that you're seeing on his bad starts is they're coming in clusters. It's like boom, boom, boom. Holy crap. Like the Grand Slam, the home runs that are normally solo shots, there's runners on base.
There were two run homers in one inning in Anaheim.
Yeah. So it's kind of a strange season in the way that he's giving up the runs, even with the splitter not being as effective as it. But look, this is also a pitch that maybe some pine tar would help with. Maybe a little bit of pine tar would help getting that split. Maybe he could get some more movement on that splitter.
Maybe
some warmer weather would be helpful.
Maybe Kikuchi was just really nervous about pitching in front of his countryman Tanaka and wanted to impress him, and that's why he used the pine tar.
Yeah, and it could be. Maybe, but it's a slight to your character, though, isn't it? Slight to your character by using the pine tar. Oh, you need an aid to beat us.
You're going to be shunned out of Japan.
I think Tanaka's going to look down on him with a scowl.
The also, there's no really alarming signs if you look at some of the velocity and movement charts on Tanaka's splitter. Everything seems normal.
That's what's so weird.
It's just it's not getting the swings and misses, so the guys aren't chasing it. Maybe they're expecting it. Maybe they're sitting on it. Finally, they're sitting on a split. But a splitter is a really hard pitch to sit on because the whole idea of a splitter is it looks like a fastball until the last minute, and then it darts out of the zone. So if you're just assuming I'm not going to swing, I'm just not swinging at this pitch ever. Maybe, but that's a hard strategy for a batter.
No, but maybe there could be something in the way that it's being thrown that it's more identifiable for some reason, and they're just spitting tipping? On it. I don't know if you'd necessarily call that tipping, but just they can see the splitter a little bit better for whatever reason, and they're just spitting on it, and they're saying, well, if a ball is starting out, you know, at X point in my zone, I'm going to lay off of it early in the count because, you know, it very well may fall off the charts. There just could be a strategy change too with the way that he's doing it. The other thing is you look at what he's doing with his other pitches, you know, working up that splitter works very well when his fastball is going. We've seen that when he starts to throw more fastballs, we see the splitter swing and miss rate increase as well because, you know, he can work off of that fastball and it doesn't need to be a 97, 98 mile an hour fastball like some of these other guys. He's 94, 95, but if he's throwing it for strikes and he's throwing it low in the zone, well, then that splitter becomes a lot more effective because, yeah, if you're not tipping it, if it does look the same out of your hand, then that splitter and the fastball look very similar, except one of them has the bottom drop off. So
we've seen the last couple seasons Tanaka just go through first half struggles.
Yes.
And if this is going to be the first half struggles that he's going through, I will much rather take this than what we saw the last 2 years, which was unmanageable.
Yeah.
You could not. We got to a point, I think 2 years ago, where it's like, do they need to pull him from the rotation? That's how bad he was. His ERA in the first half was like almost six.
Yes, he was terrible. And I think if this is the struggle, you know, we've seen for pretty much every year, as the weather gets warmer, as we get deeper into the summer, Tanaka gets better. And you know, whether that's him being more loose and guys being able to pitch better in hotter weather, and a lot of guys are like that. They're more loose. They can get a better grip on the ball. They just enjoy pitching in warmer weather and more humid weather. Than the cooler, colder weather. Some guys are just better at that. And people don't like that as an excuse, but that's a real thing. That is an absolutely real thing.
And when you look at the weather in the Northeast this year, it's been such dog crap. Every night is rain in the forecast, chill in the air. It's like, it's May now. When are we going to get some just sunny weather for, like you said, this team to, and most teams to start playing better?
Yeah. I mean, it's been a relatively mild winter / you know, for most people, I think.
It's been a terrible spring. I'm not blaming weather for anything.
You're just mad. You're just
been a terrible spring.
You're just pissed off because it's been a bad spring.
I feel like I'm living in the Pacific Northwest.
Well,
I just want to run through a couple quick updates before we get to a segment with John about the Rays. You talked to him. So Urshela fouled the ball off his leg. They're saying it's just a bruised knee, I believe. So he's probably day to day.
X-rays negative.
I do not expect him to be in the lineup on Thursday. So expect Andujar to get some a start at third base. He has just DH since his first game back, in which he played third base. He has not really looked right at the plate. He's 2-for-19 with a walk. Still looking to get him going.
Definitely looking to get him going, and maybe that's a little bit more of a normal situation for him, going to third base, hitting again. You know, I feel like as you're an everyday player and you play third base on, you know, your entire career, and then you go in and start DHing, it's different. Your routine's different. You feel different. So getting him back out there, I think, will be more of a norm, you know, bringing him back to normal. Maybe that'll help the bat a little bit too, just to get back into it.
And Andujar, get him back at third base, make a couple throwing errors, hit a couple doubles, boom, exactly. We got him back.
Miguel Andujar, back in action.
Stanton spoke to the media and said that he's going to take harder swings and, quote, see how it goes.
Yeah, start to ramp up. He was very vague in the way that he was describing his injury. Although he was talking about the fact that, you know, he did see a specialist in California. There was a cortisone shot.
But we knew he was going to do that. That wasn't a surprise. That news is 2 weeks old. People were acting like that was a breaking news story.
No,
we knew that was happening.
But when you hear it from the horse's mouth, and you hear that when he talks about the fact that he lost, you know, the majority of strength in that arm and that bicep, and you I don't think a lot of people go to that length with their mind and say that, okay, the guy lost the strength in his arm. Now he's got to build back up and get back to that point where, you know, he feels strong again. And I think that's a big deal when you're dealing with a guy who has a mechanically strange swing, who is extremely big and, you know, athletic, but his game is, you know, primarily through his strength. When you lose the strength in an arm like that, that's concerning. And we know what his mechanics are like. They're weird. They're like herky jerky. And if you're losing feeling or the ability to feel strong in one of your sides, that's concerning. And I have a feeling it's going to take him a while to get back and feel right at the plate.
Those muscle injuries are, it's weird because on the one hand, you're like, oh, it's just a quick muscle pull. You should be good to go. And just because you have no pain anymore doesn't mean, like you said, you have your full strength or full mobility or whatever it is. All right, let's talk about the upcoming Tampa series. So obviously there's one more game against the Mariners on Thursday. It's going to be Hap versus Leake. But then you had Johnny Blay on to talk about the upcoming Tampa series. The Yankees have a weird kind of road trip. It's just three games down to the House of Horrors, the Trop in Tampa, where they have just absolutely sucked for like a decade. That's sort of what you talked to John about.
Yeah, John broke down just the stats on what's happened with the Yankees in the and the Tampa Bay Devil Rays down over the last 10 years, early in their rise of the Devil Ray, if you will, with all their obscure athletes at the end of their career, the Fred McGriffs. Unfortunately, Hideki Matsui wore that horrible multicolored uniform. But the Yankees took care of them early on. But then you saw the resurgence of them in the last 10 years. The numbers have actually been relatively close. And yes, going down to the Trop has been a disaster. You know, even just as in recent memory with Clint Frazier's home run that was not a home run because it hit the freaking speaker and Hecheverria catches it for an out. It's just weird, crazy things happen. The place is ugly. It's a bandbox. We are going down there on July 6th as an invasion. We're in taking over the Trop. We're going to knock down their speakers, cut some wires, cause some ruckus. It's going to be
arrested,
a lot of fun.
Apparently.
Yeah. You know, we'll send in some people to do the dirty work. But yeah, John and I talked about that and just some, you know, some things that were interesting nuggets about the Rays, and then a little bit about this upcoming series. But it's a big series, and whoever made this schedule is hates the Yankees, because you know
just
we're at home.
Quick trip down to Tampa.
Go to the place that you hate the most for 3 days, only 3 days, and then come back. Like, what are you doing?
It's just like if your parents are retired in Florida and you got to go visit them for a weekend. That's what the Yankees are doing.
Yeah, go to Del Boca Vista. Deliver the Cadillac, come back up.
Apparently someone tweeted us this. They're wearing their throwback Devil Ray uniforms this
weekend.
I saw that. I think that's good news for the Yankees.
I think it's good news. It, now I can really call them the Devil Rays. Nobody can. Yeah. Every time I say it, someone, you know they're the Rays, right? You know they don't have the devil in the name. I get it.
All right, let's kick it to that segment right now.
All right, guys, bringing on now John Blay, who is a writer for Bronx Pinstripes and was working on a good feature. Perfect timing this week. We have the Tampa Bay Rays. We're going down to the Trop for the first time this week. And he kind of broke down what we've been dealing with over the past 10 years playing the Rays. And we're going to look into some of those stats, look into some of the numbers that we have going on this year, because the Yankees and the Rays are actually very similar in some of their team stats. So you can follow John on Twitter at Johnny Blay. That's Johnny B-L-E-H. John, what's up, man?
What's going on, man? Thanks for having me. First time, long time. it's funny. We were talking earlier, but you know, my dad used to always say that the Yankees would just struggle against the Rays. He's like, oh, we've got to go to Tampa. We're struggling against the Rays. And in my mind, I was always like, what are you talking about? The Rays aren't that great a team. And I started digging into the numbers for this article. And the Yankees have a little bit of trouble when they get down to Tampa. It's not good.
No, it's when you look at it, and everybody definitely go check out the website and the article that John wrote, so you can see all the numbers in detail. But I mean, I disrespected the Rays big time last year by calling them the Devil Rays. I was calling for the fact that we needed to go 19-0 against this team, and totally. This team of young kids that really nobody knew at that point, bullpenning, you know, every single start, it seemed like, you know, came out and started kicking ass and taking names and winning 90 games out of absolutely nowhere. So they're a surprising team.
I can't believe it. So to give you an idea of like the last 10 years, of where the two teams were before we get into the records, the Yankees had, the Yankees had some bad years in the middle, right? We know that, like the Vernon Wells era. The Yankees had bad teams from 2013 to 2016, although they were still above 500. And then they had 90-plus win teams from 2010 to 2012. And then they had 90-plus win teams in 2017. And then, of course, last year. But the Rays actually, when you look at it, had sort of similar, sort of followed a similar pattern. They had 90-plus win teams from 2010 to 2013, sort of coming off that end of the last decade with B.J. Upton and all those young guys. And then they had the 90-plus win team last year. So I guess the Rays aren't as bad as I thought they were.
Well, they are no longer the Devil Rays, although I would still call them that probably till the day I die. But, you know, they're also doing things differently, right? We've seen that since the days of Madden, where he essentially, you know, started shifting at a much higher rate than the league was doing it. And now the league has really come full circle and now everybody shifts. And
totally. Yeah. He was the leader.
And then last year we saw Kevin Cash doing this bullpenning and they kind of started that, you know, really making this bullpenning thing a big part of what they do. So mm-hmm. they've been playing the game a different way. Right. And it seems like when the Yankees play them, either they're, you know, they can't adjust to what's happening, or they're blinded by the ugliness of the Trop. I mean, there's a million things they could go on.
Yeah, I know. I think we all kind of hate Tropicana Field. And I think by the end of this podcast segment, or if you go read the article, you'll probably hate Tropicana Field a lot more once you figure out how terrible the Yankees play down there.
Yeah.
So to give you an idea of, so all time, New York is 218 and 152 against Tampa, so that, which is basically a 60% winning percentage, because they absolutely just crushed them in the 2000s during your Devil Ray years. But since 2010, they're only 85 and 83 against Tampa, which, you know, that's fine, I guess. But they're 49-35 at home when they play Tampa Bay, and they're 36-48 on the road, which is pretty terrible. I mean, to give you perspective, Boston, which you would think sort of had a better overall team over the last decade, the Yankees are 88 and 86 against them, which is basically the same record. And they actually have a 43 and 42 record in Fenway Park, which could be another article, because that surprised me. But the Yankees just are terrible in Tropicana Field.
Yeah, and Tropicana, I think, does play to their strengths. You mentioned in the article about how the pitching has, you know, the Rays always pitch well in Tampa. And, you know, at some mm-hmm. points, the Yankees have matched that to a certain extent, but the hitting has never been, you know, the same from, you know, playing at Yankee Stadium and then playing down in the Trop. And for whatever reason, the Rays, who are more built on a speed, you know, premise this year for sure. I mean, they have, I think I saw 13 triples, you know, they're stealing more bags than the Yankees. So they're going to be, you're going to see them take more advantage of on the base paths. You're going to see them get on base at a pretty good rate. But there were some surprising things too when they're looking at this year as well. And going down to Tampa this weekend, obviously, when we're looking at history and how they have played, because I think that's important, but when you're looking at this year as well, the Yankees and the Rays are very, very close in some team stats, and just I'll wing off a few of these, but OPS, the Yankees 787, Rays 777. That's fifth and sixth respectively in the league. Team batting average tied at 258. If you care about batting average anymore, I still like to look at it occasionally. On base percentage, 340 and 337. That's second and third in the AL. And then slugging, 446 and 440, which is fifth and sixth in the AL. So you're seeing similar teams in the output of the stats on a team level. There is more speed for Tampa. You're seeing that in you know, some of the stolen bases, some of the triples. But yeah, offensively, very, very similar teams.
Agreed. Yeah. And, you know, it might be indicative to the park they're in, right? It's Tropicana Field is sort of a pitcher's park, and Yankee Stadium is definitely considered a hitter's park. And so I wonder if the way that the teams have sort of been constructed over the last decade, with Tampa being a little more scrappy, right, and stealing bases and hitting runs and all that, because they're in a pitcher's park and they might have to do those types of things because they can't rely on the home run as much. I don't know. Maybe that's part of the reason why the Yankees, who are pretty reliant on the home run, although not right now, which is why they're so fun to watch, struggle down there.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny when you're looking at the numbers too offensively. The fact that the Yankees with the replacements, like all these replacement AAA guys, yeah, have similar numbers to where the Rays are, is maybe that's more telling on you know what we're going into. It's a similar, you know, similar caliber team in the sense of talent, I guess, you know. And that's why we're not seeing the power as much, obviously, with some of the Yankees big guns out. But they're definitely, you know, producing at a similar level. The pitching, though, the pitching is different. The pitching is very different. Yeah, the Rays are team ERA now 2.91, which is crazy.
That's insane.
And Yankees at 3.73, which is good for first and third in the league. Mm-hmm. And they're a little different, right? We're not seeing the bullpenning as much. They actually have some legitimate starters that are going to be going up against us.
Totally. And some of the big Yankees pitchers have never pitched well down there. Tanaka has a 4.66 ERA down there, even though it's a pitcher's park. Severino has a 3.46 ERA, 1.35 WHIP, which is good, but definitely higher than his otherwise dominant numbers. And I looked at some other guys over the decade. I mean, CC has a 3.68 ERA, which I guess is good, but when you look at his whole career, isn't that good, with an 8-9 record. Hiroki Kuroda, who was with the team for a couple of years, he has a 6 ERA down there. So I don't know what it is, because it's definitely a pitcher's park. Tampa Bay Ray pitchers always do really well down there. For some reason, maybe it's the turf. Maybe it's the ugliness. I don't know.
It's bad. I mean, I thought you had something about the turf in there as well, but it seemed like the Yankees, when they go on to turf, they do. I mean, turf is fast, right? Everybody knows that. It's a faster game when you play on turf. So the fact that they're built that way as well, you know, hitting gaps, you saw it in the triples. I mean, they're I think second in the league, second or third in the league in triples. So they have the speed to play, I guess, with the, you know, with that turf as well.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I won't, without undermining this whole thing that maybe it's just Tropicana Field, I did look up their record since 2010 against Toronto, and they're actually 35-48 up at the Rogers Center. So that'll have to be the next research, is maybe domes and turf are just not the Yankees' forte.
Yeah. Maybe the new kids will like to play on it better. So looking forward to this weekend. We have the pitching matchups right now are not announced, but just kind of doing some guessing. It looks Snell pitched on Monday, so we'll probably see him, and he's definitely not, he's been injured, but not pitching as well, probably because he's coming back from this injury. But obviously we know what he is. I mean, he's the reigning Cy Young champ, 3-3 with a 3.62. But then Glasnow pitched last Friday. This kid is unbelievable right now, who came over in the Chris Archer deal, 6-0 with a 1.47. I mean, that worked out beautifully for them. He pitched last Friday, seriously, so we'll see him. And then Torinos was last Saturday. They've had a couple rainouts, so it looks like they're holding back some of these guys just for us.
Well, that's great. Yeah. Hey, again, though, you know, we can't hit the bullpen in, so I guess we should just be happy that they're going to throw three aces at us instead of the bullpen, and maybe something will happen.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it seems like the they've been bullpenning one of those slots, you know, filling in with another one if they're holding a guy back. That's kind of happened with these guys. But we'll see. I think it's going to be a fun series. I like the fact that there's, you know, some good competition. They're not taking anybody by surprise anymore, right? Like, they're a 90 win team now, so we see them coming. There's no doubt about that.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Right.
But this weekend will be a fun. Yankees will be going up against some good pitching, and pretty much, you know, depending on what happens these next couple of days versus Seattle, probably for first place in the AL East.
Yeah, you would think so. Right, this team's on fire right now, so hopefully there's a big Seattle sweep. Gio Urshela, you know, he'll go like 10 for 14 in Tampa Bay, and then we'll crush him.
That's it. I love it. All right, John, I appreciate you coming on, man. Guys, if you want to follow John, go to Johnny Blay on Twitter and give him a follow and read his article on Tampa. And he's got a bunch of other stuff on there, writing every week for Bronx Pinstripes. John, thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks, man. It's a great time.
Okay, we're back. And the Yankees could see Tyler Glasnow this weekend, who has been the Rays' best pitcher. You're automatically just going to think Blake Snell, Cy Young winner, who has been solid, but he had an injury issue, kept him out of a couple starts. Glasnow, meanwhile, is leading the American League. I believe he's leading all starters in ERA, and he's fourth in pitcher WAR, and he has six wins. Wins don't matter, but he's 6-0. He has been like their next ace find that this team just seems to continue to churn out.
Yeah, they flipped Chris Archer for Glasnow, who was seemingly a problem for the Pirates. They couldn't get him healthy or going or whatnot. Now all of a sudden he comes over to Tampa and is healthy and is pitching well. And yeah, he hasn't pitched in a while. So by the time we're recording this, or when we're recording this, they have not announced the starters. But when you look at what's going on, Morton just pitched, so we're not going to see him. But most likely we'll see Glasnow, Snell, and then probably Chirinos in a game as well. So we're going to get their best. We're going to get their best, and it'll be interesting because this is a tightly contested AL East right now. And, you know, depending on what happens tonight, Thursday, this whole series could absolutely be for the, you know, the AL East. You know, whoever comes out on top could be leading the AL East at the end.
We're starting to see the teams bunch up now. As we sit here Thursday morning, the Rays are in first, Yankees are in second, two back of Tampa, and Boston's back to 500. They're only three back of the Yankees. So, yeah, April was weird where the Yankees had a ton of injuries and the Red Sox struggled, but we're starting to see everyone, the cream rise to the top.
Yep, and Chris Sale is starting to pitch a lot better, and they're hitting the ball out. Mookie Betts just hit a big home run last night.
Do not act shocked about this. I'm not saying you are if you're a fan. Do not act shocked that the Red Sox are starting to figure it out. Just say, you know what? That's nice that they decided to suck for a month. That's going to give everyone that allowed the Yankees, who went through a barrage of injuries, to weather the storm.
I appreciate that they were horrible. I don't think anybody who's watched baseball for a significant amount of time knows that the Red Sox were not going to be down. Anybody who looks at their lineup realizes that they're not going to be down for as long as they. I do think that it's interesting that they're playing better now, which we expected. But I think later in the season, we're going to see them really put to the test with that bullpen, with some of the pitching woes, with Chris Sale, you know, seemingly every single year start to struggle towards the end of the year or get tired or whatnot. Maybe the fact that he started off slow was a good thing for them.
I think it was by design, honestly.
So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, when you looked, you know, in the August month, they could struggle again. And then we'll start looking back at their April and say, OK, well, that was a significant piece of this season for them.
All right. I want to end the show with a quick topic about Sabathia, who was asked about what he wants to do in retirement. I saw this quote, I think it was in the New York Times. He said, "I would love to do yes. I think me and Ruko would be fun doing the games on the air. I'm not wearing a suit. Why do I need to wear a suit to talk about baseball? It's effing stupid to wear a suit. Guys on the field aren't wearing dress clothes. People in the stands aren't wearing dress clothes. It makes no sense. If they let me go up there in a Jordan sweatsuit, I'll do games all day."
He was brought up. So the game last night.
He wants to drape himself in velvet.
He does want to drape himself in velvet. The big man does not want to be constricted. When he retires, he wants to be comfortable at all times. I don't blame him. He's a big man. He's probably going to eat a lot more food. We're going to see this guy. He's going to be comfortable. He deserves it. He's earned himself the velour. You know? So look, I think it's funny because he's talking about this. Last night, the game was also on ESPN. So I was watching that for a little bit too. Mike Petrillo was was actually on Petriello. Petriello was actually on the broadcast as well, and he was really good. The interesting thing is that CC still talking about the jumpsuit, doubling down on this. Them all saying, "Yeah, we could, you know, we'll sign off on that. We'll sign off on it." I think people will let him do it in a jumpsuit.
I tried to figure out where the whole sports announcers wearing suits originated, and the only thing I could find is that because back in the day when you went to a sporting event as a spectator, you dressed up, that it was always an event and everyone dressed up. And then that trend for sportscasters continued through the 70s, through the 80s. It's just a really tacky, bright-colored, mustard-colored suits. And then now you see guys like dressed up in like Gucci suits. And it's like, what are you doing? It is July. It's 87 and humid out. And you're wearing a friggin' suit on a baseball game. It's just, I think it's stupid. I think if you're talking about sports, you should be dressed like a sports fan, which is in a t-shirt and jeans.
I don't agree with this. There's a level of professionalism for the fact that you're a broadcaster as well. And dressing up is part of that professionalism. You see it across the sports. If you're on camera, if you're not on camera and you're a beat guy, well, yeah, you can wear, you know, something that's a little bit more, you know, a little bit more casual, little Friday casual for the office. But when you're on camera, you do the respect of being dressing up. You do it for the Vince Scullys of the world. You do it for the John Sterlings of the world. And you look your best.
Those guys want to do that. If the legends of the game want to continue to wear suits, great.
There's a level of respect from the people that are also continuing the profession to keep up the tradition of looking good on camera.
What is wrong? And sometimes you see this. The guys in Yes will wear a polo with the Yes logo on it.
Yep.
What is wrong with that?
I think that's okay too. As long as you're saying t-shirt and jeans.
I was taking it to the nth degree there. But why? I just think suits are a little overboard, especially when it's a summer sport. And in the summer months, these guys are wearing suits and ties, and it is friggin' disgustingly hot out.
I think the polo.
Like, I don't want to watch Michael Kay sweat through his suit on air. I don't want to watch.
Well, you don't. That's why he has a jacket. He'll cover that up for you. But you'll see his gouging hand on Twitter in freaking detail. What are you doing, Michael? Why are you tweeting that out? It's just not for anybody to see. The guy is like so concerned about like things that he eats and like weird about certain things. Yet he
doesn't eat vegetables.
Yet he'll tweet out his bloody finger that has like a gushing wound from it that looks. It's just weird. But I got no problem with it. I got no problem with the polo.
He talked about how like he was like trying to lose weight and everything, and then he also talks about how he doesn't eat vegetables. And it's like, hey, maybe if you ate a couple of vegetables, you'd lose some weight.
That would help.
Ever think of that?
Your diet would be in a good position if you could actually balance it.
All right, that's gonna do it for us. Next episode is a reminder, just guys, submit mailbag questions, bronxpinstripes.com/podcast, and you can also tweet us at Yankees Podcast. Scott, what's up?
Also, if you guys are in Philadelphia, Salt Lake City, there are BP crew events at the different chapters on Saturday. Go look at our Twitter accounts. We're tweeting out when all these events are. You can also go to Facebook and search BP crew and join the group. If you're in another city, chances are we have a chapter or we're trying to start a chapter in your city. So that you can get Yankees fans together, watch these games. If there's an opponent in your city, we're going to look at doing a game event, an invasion there. We're doing our first one in Tampa on July 6th. So go do that, but definitely check the ones out coming up this weekend.
We've got a few people, and there's more reviews that came in from Idaho. There's Yankee fans in Idaho. They want to start a chapter.
I saw that. I saw the reviews coming in from Idaho. I'm loving it. I'm loving this Idaho chapter. We need to do it.
I need to call out other states. Like, where are all the New Mexico Yankee fans at?
Yeah, they don't exist. They don't exist.
Prove you guys exist by leaving us a review in iTunes. If you're a Yankees fan in New Mexico, Walter White and his cronies out there selling meth out in New Mexico. That's the only thing I know about New Mexico.
It's the only thing I know about New Mexico. Prove me wrong. Please.
Yeah.
Enlighten us. Educate us about New Mexico.
And finally, George's Box episode 8 came out on Wednesday. Go find that on all podcast platforms. The guys ran through the last week of Yankees baseball in addition to a lot of things around the league, including a thirsty chick who slid into Bryce Harper's what she thought was Bryce Harper's DMs turned out to be Bryce Harper's wife's DMs.
That's a solid move. They will also probably talk about the sneaker game a lot more, a lot better than we can.
All right, we'll talk to you Monday.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.